From Variety, I'm Michael Schneider. Emmy-nominated actress Laverne Cox admits she lived the Samantha lifestyle in late 90s New York City, which is one of the reasons she was such a huge fan of HBO's Sex and the City.
Sex and the City, for me, a lot of it was about the time in my life, living in New York as well, going to a lot of the same nights, haunts as Carrie and the girls.
Drinking Cosmos,
you know, getting into Bungalow 8 and having, my little romps. I was thinking about, the TV that, I've watched over and over and over again and never get tired of. And there's every episode of Sex and the City I've watched multiple times and can quote lines from.
On this edition of the podcast, we talk to Laverne Cox, Emmy-nominated as a guest star for reprising her role as Sophia on Orange is the New Black, as she wows us with her in-depth knowledge of all things Sex and the City. We also talk about the legacy of that Netflix series and her favorite installment of that show as well. It's my favorite episode.
My favorite episode. Let's talk TV. TV. My favorite episode makes me so. Welcome to Variety's My Favorite Episode. Let's give it up for your host, Michael Schneider.
Thank you, DJ Omar Khan, for the theme song. It's My Favorite Episode, and this time out, we're talking to Laverne Cox. Cox's favorite episode is Running with Scissors, the 11th episode of Season 3 from Sex and the City, which first aired August 20, 2000. Written by Michael Patrick King and directed by Dennis Erdman, in this episode, Carrie, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, continues her affair with Mr. Big. But as things progress, they end up meeting at dingy hotel rooms, and Carrie starts to question, what is she doing? Ruining her relationship with Aiden and also coming between Big and his new wife. This is the episode where it all comes tumbling down. Meanwhile, also in this episode, Samantha, played by Kim Cattrall, meets the male version of Samantha, who wants her first to get tested for HIV. Samantha has surprisingly never done so, leading to this hysterical exchange with her doctor.
And across town, Samantha felt as though she might cry as well.
Have you had an HIV test before?
No.
I'm sorry, I'm really nervous. Try to relax. There's just a couple of routine questions, nothing to be alarmed about.
Okay. Thanks.
Now, do you have sex?
Yes.
Do you have oral sex? Give, receive?
Yes. Yes, yes.
Do you have anal sex?
Yes.
Do you swallow?
Only when surprised.
Do you use condoms?
Yes.
What kind of condoms?
Trojan, Lifestyles, Chic, Wet and Wild.
No, I meant latex, lambskin.
Oh, yes. Yes.
How many sexual partners have you had?
I'm counting. This year?
Later this episode, we discuss Cox's favorite episode of Orange is the New Black ever, Lesbian Request Denied, the third episode of Season 1. Directed by Jodie Foster, it's the backstory of Cox's character, how she became Sophia and ended up at Litchfield Penitentiary. As Orange is the New Black winds up its seventh and final season, we began by discussing the show's legacy for both her and television in general.
It's not been bitter at all. It's just been sweet, the whole process. I think, I remember reading an interview from Gingy, season one, and I remember her saying in that interview that she knew she had about seven seasons in her. And I don't know, I think when I read that, that didn't suggest that we would be done after seven seasons, but I thought that if Netflix wanted us, we would probably, you know, stay around that long. And so seven feels like a really good number.
Yeah, lucky seven.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So what's it been like in reuniting with the cast, the folks who you've been on this journey with along the way?
It's so weird since I moved to Los Angeles, and a lot of our cast, a lot of my castmates still live in New York, and so I haven't seen a lot of them in a while. And I, even in the episodes that I've shot, I don't always shoot with everyone, so I don't see everybody. So it was great at the premiere getting to see a lot of folks that I hadn't seen in a while, and then doing a little bit of press. We lit the Empire State orange in celebration of the seventh season of Orange is New Black, so I got to do that with a few of the castmates, and it was really special.
Yeah, yeah, it's a reminder of just how important this show was. Important for Netflix, important for television in general.
And still is.
And still is.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, and to be a part of that, what has this journey meant for you?
In 2012, I turned 40, and I was in a tremendous amount of debt. I was on a payment plan to avoid eviction from my apartment, and I thought that maybe it was time for me to do something else, to actually make some money, and I don't know, just turning 40 is like a big deal in some people's lives, and it was, I just felt like I hadn't accomplished what I had hoped I wanted to as an artist. And so I thought it was time to do something else. And so I bought the GRE sort of study materials from a friend of mine at a discount and started studying for grad school and figuring out where I was going to apply. And the Orange audition came a few months after my 40th birthday, and I booked it. And I got out of debt.
I would hope so.
Because of the show, I paid my rent after we shot the third episode of this season, which was Sophia's backstory. I got a lot of overtime. I was still in a day rate. I was able to pay my rent 6 months in advance, which was amazing. My rent wasn't that high, and that's what made, you know, me not being able to pay it even more sort of humiliating at the time. And so, I mean, that's where I was 7 years ago, and now I'm in a completely different place. And beyond what the show has done for my life, it has changed the trajectory of television for, I think, certainly for trans folks on television, but for women of color, for the LGBTQ plus community in general. And just Netflix has sort of ushered in an entirely new age of television. I always say this jokingly that, you know, when we started 7 years ago, Netflix and chill was not part of the cultural conversation. It wasn't even a phrase. And now Netflix has changed the game, and Orange is the New Black has certainly been a part of that. And I am so grateful that I got to be on the ride.
Yeah, yeah. And the success of this show has beget other shows that have gone on to success as well, you know, like Pose on FX.
Absolutely.
And just opened the door for a lot, and that's just got to be gratifying to have been a part of this.
It's insanely gratifying. The first season, Pose, came out, and I was in Los Angeles, and all these wonderful billboards went up with India Moore and Dominique Jackson and
MJ Rodriguez.
Black trans women on billboards as if it's nothing. And I remember going to the doctor, and there was Dominique was on a bus shelter, and I just started crying. I was like, this is like, I just remember the first time I was on a billboard and like how much that meant to so many people. And like, openly trans black people had not been on billboards before Orange is the New Black. And so it's just, I'm like, what is going on?
Yeah.
It's so, I'm just so happy and proud.
Yeah, yeah. And it's sort of, there's so much negativity going on in the world right now.
Oh, yeah.
It's sometimes tough. It's tough to live in this world at this moment. So you got to take the wins, and you got to take the positivity where you can.
And the responsibility of the artist becomes really foregrounded now. I'm nominated for an Emmy, my third Emmy. I'm still the only trans person to be nominated for an acting Emmy. And in this world that is so turbulent, where so many groups of people are being scapegoated by our government, where trans people are under attack by our government, right? We've been banned from the military. They want to discriminate against us in housing, in healthcare. To have trans folks on television now and to be nominated for an Emmy in this cultural environment feels so special, and it just highlights that the importance of the work of the artist. That it's not, yes, we want to make people laugh, we want to, you know, entertain people, but we have the opportunity to represent people who are underrepresented culturally, and it is an insanely amazing honor, but a weight that we must carry as artists. But artists have always carried that weight, and I believe in the power of art to sort of be arbiters of empathy and arbiters of compassion for our fellow human beings. And so, right now, we have a lot of work to do.
Right, right. But Orange always threaded that needle pretty well in being such an entertaining show and such a, you know, the character development of everyone on that show. And that's a big cast, you know, to sort of, you know, be able to really show the humanity of these folks, of these characters, and also do what you were saying and sort of advancing the conversation and hopefully shedding light on some of these issues. Again, not easy to do.
Absolutely not. And Gingy has really been committed from jump. I remember we had the honor of honoring Gingy Cohen for an organization called the Feminist Majority many years ago. And that night, Shonda Rhimes was also honored. And then Gingy Cohen and Shonda Rhimes had a conversation on stage, which was pretty epic and pretty amazing. Mm-hmm. And I remember this is ahead of, I forget which season it was ahead of. It's just all sort of a blur at this point. But I remember Gingy Cohen asked the question, do you believe someone who is a rapist is still has humanity? Still has, and in a room with, you know, a room full of feminists, a lot of people were like, no. And Gingy was like, well, I disagree. And that, and it's complicated, right? You know, as a sexual assault survivor myself, it's complicated. But my job as an artist is never to dehumanize any of the characters that I play, to always look for the space of empathy and humanity in every single human being. And that is our job as artists. And Gingy and our incredible writers have done that for 7 seasons of a show. And I think it takes a lot of courage when you are portraying people who have done horrible things sometimes, but their humanity is still not lost, even though they may have done something horrible. You've done something horrible, but you're not horrible.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's really interesting. It's a show, again, that, you know, it's interesting also to see the evolution of the culture the past 7 years.
Oh, yes.
and how much, you know, the conversation has changed. You know, this predated Me Too, this predated you know, Time's Up, and of course predated that what happened with the White House, that whose name shall not be spoken, but nonetheless, to have been on this ride while so much is going on in the real world, mm-hmm. must have also been sort of just the juxtaposition of what's going on outside and the stories that you were telling mm-hmm. on this show.
Yeah, and Gingy's always found a way in our way, in our Orange way, to deal with this and address a number of those issues. I remember reading the script, I think it was season 4, at the end of season 4, when, spoiler alert, if you haven't watched season 4, I don't know what to say, when Pusey Washington was murdered by a CO, and... I feel like there's so many moments in our show that have transcended a television show, but for all of us, when we were shooting that, there, you know, we were living in a reality where we were routinely seeing Black people killed on camera by mm-hmm. police, almost on a daily basis. And for us to go there and tackle this subject with really one of our most beloved characters, when I started doing my college tour in 2013, I swear to you, like the first 3 years of our show, during my Q&As, people were always asking me about Pusey and Samira. Like, people love her.
Right.
Love that character. And she meant so much and means so much to so many people all over the world. And for us to, I mean, it's like, how do you do that?
Yeah.
But I think Gingy chose that to have a certain kind of impact for us to really grapple with the reality of what it means for so many people all over this country to be losing their loved ones to police violence and to a system that systematically dehumanizes Black folks.
Yeah, and I always think about Samira going from that to Handmaid's Tale.
And winning an Emmy!
Yeah, yeah.
Oh!
So,
and she's so good on that show.
Yeah, yeah.
She's so good on that show. She's such a, she's such an amazing human being. She's such an amazing woman. And just watching her grow as an artist over these years, too, has been incredible. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Well, you guys, I mean, murderer's row of talent on Orange. And to see the also how everyone has, like, gone on to such amazing things, too.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I mean, look at you, for example.
No, I mean, I was thinking about so many of my. I don't want to, like, if you name names, you leave people out. But there's been such incredible. Our show has been such an incredible gift for so many of us, and a lot of us who were not conventionally anything have found ways to have a career. And I don't know if, like, Samira Wiley is insanely talented as she is. I mean, would the world have found a space for her if it weren't for Orange Is the New Black with all that talent?
Yeah.
There have been, you know, a lot of people with a lot of talent have been looked over for a long time. And our show has given a space and a platform to so much talent. I think of Asia Kate Dillon, who started out on our show and now is killing it
right.
on Billions. And is a two-time Critics Choice nominee and his blazed this beautiful trail for non-binary actors on television.
Yeah.
And Asia started out on our show.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Again, blazing trails at the Emmys as well. So,
yes.
Well, so switching gears real quick, I gave mm-hmm. you a little bit of an assignment.
Yes.
So to choose your favorite episode of mm-hmm. TV ever. You picked a landmark Sex and the City episode.
Is it a landmark Sex and the City episode? It is.
A lot happens in this episode.
It's my favorite, and it's really, do you want to preface it a little bit, or try? Or?
Season 3, episode 11, Running with Scissors. Michael Patrick King, who of course was the showrunner for many years, wrote mm-hmm. this episode. Dennis Erdman was the director. But this is a key episode where Big and Carrie had been sort of carrying on an affair, and shit hits the fan in this episode.
Oh, yes. It's so interesting, trying to pick my favorite episode of television ever is really hard.
Yeah.
And Sex and the City and Breaking Bad are my two favorite shows of all time. And for very different reasons. But Sex and the City for me, a lot of it was about the time in my life, living in New York as well. Going to a lot of the same nights, you know, haunts as Carrie and the girls.
Drinking Cosmos.
Cosmos, you know, getting into Bungalow 8 and having, like, my little romps. But Running with Scissors, it's like, I was thinking about, like, the TV that, like, I've watched over and over and over again and never get tired of. And there's every episode of Sex and the City I've watched multiple times and can quote lines from. But Running with Scissors was, like, sort of the culmination of the Big Carrie, the dysfunction of it in this really substantial way. So you know, Carrie and Big, they break up at the end of the first season. They get back together in the second season, break up again in La Douleur Exquise, that lovely episode was sort of with this, you know, the exquisite pain in season two. And then he gets engaged very quickly to Natasha at the end of season two. And so by the beginning of season three, we see Carrie single again, and he's getting married, and then this whole Natasha thing, you know, Nijinsky, Natasha, if you are a big fan. And so by the time we get to Running with Scissors, Carrie has started up this affair with Big after he's gotten married. And it's just a hot, hot mess.
Yeah.
But what I love about this episode is, I love so many things about it, but with the Big Carrie romance, this it sort of starts off very sort of old Hollywood, and she looks fabulous, and they're in these fabulous hotel rooms having this affair, and then it sort of quickly disintegrates. Disintegrates.
Yeah.
Thank you. Into them going to these very sort of dingy motel rooms on 48th and 8th, where no one knows them, so that they won't get caught. And Big is such an asshole in so many moments in this. There's a moment when she's like sort of frustrated, and then he's like, "Are you saving it for your boyfriend?" Because of course, not only is Big married to Natasha, but Carrie is dating Aiden and has started this affair. And Aiden is just the sweetest man ever, and she's cheating on him, and it's just horrible. But then also during this episode, Samantha meets the male Samantha. I forget his name. Do you remember his name?
I forget it, but yeah.
She meets the male Samantha. I should have rewatched this episode, but I've seen it enough times. So, and then they want to have sex, and he wants to have sex with her on a swing, which is so crazy.
Life's a lot like Sex in the City.
Life is a lot like Sex in the City. Yeah.
Oh yeah. So I was going to ask you, have you had a chance to meet some of the folks who are involved? SJP.
I met SJP once, at a benefit. I think it was last year, and she was positively delightful. And I've loved her since Square Pegs, if I'm being, you know, that hardcore.
Yeah.
And I met Cynthia Nixon at another benefit, interestingly enough. She introduced me, and I introduced Hillary Clinton.
just that.
Cynthia Nixon is delightful. She's such a brilliant actress and just lovely. And I've met Kristen Davis as well. We met at, I think, an Emmy party or something.
Yeah.
And she was just delightful. So the only one I've not met is
Kim Cattrall.
Kim Cattrall.
Yeah, yeah. But you mentioned Mario Cantone, so you've gotten to
yes,
know?
Yes, I've met Mario Cantone a few times. Mario, I think, was a co-host on The View when, or he was a guest on The View when I was a co-host, or he was a co-host when I was a guest or something.
Yeah, he's been on The View a lot.
Yeah, I've met Mario a few times on The View, and he is just, oh my God, he's just, Mario's everything.
Yeah, yeah.
He's really a national treasure.
No, he's a riot, and you could tell from that first episode, this Running with Scissors, like, oh, they're going to use him more, because he's sort of the perfect foil for Charlotte, and he's kind of, he does the things that Charlotte is too prim and proper to do.
Absolutely.
You know, the whole dress scene where she hated it, or whatever he says to,
he's, like, they're not paid, what is it, they're not paid, what is the line, they're not paid to,
oh, yeah.
They're paid to make you happy or whatever.
Right, because she's worried, like, she's going to think I'm a bitch. And he's like,
they're not paid to think. They're paid to make you happy.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So, something like that. So just perfectly delivered. But so much going
and,
on there.
And then the moment when they finally end up with her, Big and Carrie are at his home, Big's home, having their affair. And he's gone off to work. And Carrie's there. And once Charlotte finds out about the affair, she's like, how much do you know about Natasha? You know, and Carrie's sort of walking through Natasha's home, and how much do I know about her? At one point, she was the idiot stick figure with no soul. And then Natasha comes in, and Carrie's still there, and she tries to, like, escape from the back of Big's apartment, and then Natasha sees her and runs after her and then falls down the stairs and chips a tooth, and she's bleeding. And Carrie has to, and Carrie takes her to the hospital. It's just a mess.
Just a mess. And then it's Big shows up.
And he shows up. And then he's like, call me. And she's like, why? You know, we're so over. We need a new word for over. And then she looks fabulous. I think she I remember there was a cross body bag. I don't remember which bag it was. She had this denim jacket on. And then she comes home and Aiden is there just waiting. And she goes, and he's like, oh, you know, what were you doing? She's like, oh, just going to the museum, you know. And then she goes and washes her face. And the episode ends there. And it's just...
Right,
it's
right.
It's just, it's heartbreaking and complicated and...
Yeah, because you know Aiden also is, he knows something's going on. So they both in this episode have completely destroyed their relationships, but yet they're not ready to come back together either. So it's just a lot of...
They weren't ready for quite some time. We needed three more seasons for that.
So how big of a fan were you? Like, you stuck through the movies. A lot of people weren't big fans of that second movie.
I'm going to be honest. I personally prefer the series to the movies.
Yeah.
I think, to be honest, I think I know a lot of people hate the second movie. I thought the second movie was actually more true to the series than the first movie was. The first movie was probably a better film, but the second movie had this this sort of irreverence of the series, and Samantha, you know, sort of, Samantha always did something to kind of ruin the fun. Like, something with Samantha's, you know, sexcapades, you know. In the second film, it was obviously her making out with this guy on the beach, with the Australian dude on the beach, and then he gets an erection, and it's, you know, and they're in Abu Dhabi, and it's, you know, a Muslim country, and all of these things are forbidden. But then that reminds me of the episode, and also in the third season, where they end up at the Playboy Mansion, if you know that, and it's the whole fake Fendi episode where Samantha gets a fake Fendi, and then they end up at the Playboy Mansion, and someone stole her fake Fendi, and Samantha thinks that one of the Playboy bunnies stole her fake Fendi, but the Playboy bunny's Fendi is actually real, and they all get kicked out of the Playboy Mansion, and it's just, it's just that. There's so many of those kinds of moments in Samantha's storyline that I think is, that I really just enjoyed and about this series. And it was sort of a nostalgia thing for me with that second movie with the series. Yeah. There are all sorts of, what's interesting too about Sex and the City, and from a critical perspective, a lot of folks talk about Sex and the City sort of changing the nature of New York City and the sort of conspicuous consumption, some of the race issues, and there were trans issues on that show as well, for sure. Trans women appeared on the show. I remember specifically it was the last episode of season three, at last episode of season three, I forget the name of the episode, where there were some trans women. Samantha has moved into the meatpacking district, and there were some trans women who were sex workers who were very loud outside of Samantha's apartment. And she, sort of ends up confronting some of the trans sex workers, and they're very sort of othered. Mm-hmm. And what was interesting and weird for me at the time watching the show is I was just like, why is the first time that we encounter trans women on Sex in the City is that we were sex workers who were kind of in a completely different world than the women of this city. I'm like, I was just at Bungalow 8 last week. Like, what, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to so many of the same places and living, certainly. I mean, I think what was great about Carrie, too, is that she never had a lot of money, but she managed to live a fabulous life. And I know so many people who lived in New York City who were broke as a joke and managed to go to the best clubs and the best whatever and found a way to not have a lot of money, but to live a kind of fabulous life because of who you knew. And so it felt like so, it was disappointing for me as a trans woman, as a black trans woman, to see black trans women sort of enter this world of Sex and the City and be so thoroughly othered. But being critical of the show in that way didn't stop me from also loving the show in other ways.
Right.
And there are lots of things culturally that can be problematic in one way, and we can watch those things and engage with them critically. That doesn't mean we need to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
That's when you're reminded that, oh, this show is 20 years old. So,
oh my God, it is.
I mean, not to age us, but
no, it started in 1998, actually.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So that's where you do notice some things and watch. Even in this episode we're talking about, there's a line where it's like, delete me from your Palm Pilot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh, that's right. This show is kind of ancient now. They're celebrating the 25th anniversary of Friends right now. Another show that, hasn't aged well to some degree. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of conversation about, a lot of gay panic jokes and things like that 25 years ago. And then just also
race issues on Friends as well that they tried to rectify, and with varying degrees of
So the good news is, the
but
culture
the times
has
changed. But the times change, and hopefully we as artists can continue to do the work to reflect the changing times and look back on a great show like Friends, which is a great show, and a great show like Sex and the City, and not feel like we need to discard the whole thing because it. For its time, and still now, I think a lot of it holds up. I think Sex and the City holds up remarkably well.
Yeah.
I mean, the fourth season for me, I love the third season. It was the sort of penultimate. It was the only season that they won an Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series, and it's the first time a cable show won an Emmy for Outstanding Comedy Series.
I love that you have all this information.
Yeah, I don't know why, and I just forgot I knew that. But
I need if there's ever a trivia night for Sex and the City, I need Laverne Cox on my team.
Yes, you do.
You would kill.
Yes, you do, and. And also Sarah Jessica Parker and Cynthia Nixon won Emmys for that last season as well. And so there's just, but the fourth season of that show is so beautiful. There's episodes, The Good Fight, when Carrie and Aiden, they finally get gotten back together and they move in together. I love that episode, All That Glitters, when Charlotte has this seemingly perfect marriage, but they're not having sex, and then Trey doesn't want to have a baby, and they've been trying. And there's just so many beautiful change of address when Aiden and Carrie break up for the second time, mm-hmm. when she doesn't want to wear, he's proposed, and she doesn't want to wear the ring on her hand. She's wearing it around her neck, and she's in this beautiful white dress after the black and white ball that Richard Wright throws, and Samantha now wants Richard to be monogamous when she didn't want him to be. It's such a beautiful show, and it just deals, that fourth season just delves into the complexities of, once you are in relationships, what happens, and are you able to sustain them, and how things that may look great on the outside, once you're in them, they're really not so great, or they're way more complicated than you imagine.
Yeah, yeah.
Love the fourth season of Sex and the City. Obsessed.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, not to go too deep into the post 9/11 Sex and the City, but the tone did change.
Season 5.
Yeah, and sort of that's where people started to, maybe I do want to settle down. Maybe I do want to find, the mate. And I think, even subliminally, the tone kind of changed.
You really feel
show.
The post 9/11 Sex and the City in season 5. And that was an abbreviated season because Sarah Jessica Parker was pregnant. And it was the end, big. Big moved. He had gone to move to California. She had broken up with Aiden. She started working at Vogue, and she bought her apartment with Charlotte's ring. And so she's just sort of not dated for a while at the beginning of season 5, and she's just sort of lost her you know, her groove in a way. And season 5 is really all about Samantha. It's
yeah.
really all about Samantha. There's just some gems. That's the season she won a Golden Globe for. Here I go again. But there's so many. I mean, when she gets the chemical peel and goes to Carrie's book party, when she returns the vibrator. I mean, this is like classic, epic Sex and the City, when Samantha sort of gives this tutorial at, Sharper Image with these vibrators, you know, back massagers, a.k.a. vibrators. It's just some really classic, gorgeous work for Kim Cattrall in that 5th season.
So you said at the time you were Samantha. Who are you now?
Well, that was a combination of Samantha and Miranda.
Yeah.
Now I'm Laverne.
Exactly. You have your own show.
I'm Laverne in that I... You know, I think I was always probably, I was Samantha, but I think I was a closeted Charlotte. I think I always wanted to sort of believe in true love and find true love, and I didn't think it was possible for me. And so I did what I could do, you know, and that was be Samantha.
Yeah.
And and now I'm just Laverne.
Yeah.
I it's interesting. I think growing up, but coming more into my own womanhood, I'm a little bit of all of them. I think my Samantha days are over. I'm single again, so maybe I need to get a little more Samantha in me. But I think my Samantha days are over.
Yeah.
I think I'm, you know, I can still stretch and do some of the things I used to do. But
well, I wanted to bring Brianna into the conversation. Now you're a little younger. Did you watch Sex and the City or
not growing up? When the show started, I was 2 years
yeah,
old.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's probably not,
my God.
Probably not appropriate.
But. No, but I mean, growing up, my mother loved Sex and the City, so I've always been able to watch from her perspective and kind of see where she identified with characters. That's interesting that you said that you were Samantha at a point and then you've transformed and taken on other characters. I'm wondering, also with the point that you made about relationships, was there a couple that you loved to hate on the show?
A couple I loved to hate? Oh my gosh, that is a really good question. A lot of Carrie's relationships pre-Aiden were just, you know, her waiting for Mr. Big to come back around. I'm Charlotte and Trey. I think there was something. Trey was in so many ways ideal for Charlotte, and then he just turned really into a colossal asshole once they got married. And Charlotte wanted to have a baby, and it was hard, and he just wanted to sort of give up, and he just checked out. And I think there are so many men in relationships who just check out. Women maybe do this as well, but I guess I'm just speaking from my own experience as a woman who dates men. And the way he checked out on her when she was so fervently in, when she endured so much with his erectile dysfunction, and he just checked out. And it's infuriating and frustrating to be in a relationship when a man is still there, but he's just checked out. And he was even suggested he was fine with her having an affair at one point when they weren't having sex. And so that relationship was infuriating for me on so many levels.
And refresh my memory, he also had like this weird relationship with his mother.
Oh, Bunny, which is genius.
Yeah.
The actress who played Bunny was just delightful and divine. And just,
but that's like the red flag right there.
There was an episode, I think, when he gets the flu and Charlotte's sort of nursing him back to health, and he and Bunny finds out he has the flu and comes over and like moves into the house, into their Park Avenue, you know, apartment with him, and just sort of starts like, you know, taking care of him in the way Charlotte wants to. And at one point she's like, you got to get out of here. And then Charlotte wanted to redecorate the apartment too. Mm. So this is like her, you know, I'm going to put the, you know, Vicks vapor rub on his chest and I'm redecorating the apartment. Bunny was genius. Oh my God. When they get the divorce and oh my God. Anyway, I love this show so much. Obsessed. Do you have any other questions for me?
I was going to say also, you know, I think that is a great inclusion that they added a character like Charlotte among the other women, because she's very traditional, and some people, you know, they felt like she was a little bit, you know, a step backwards from the other characters because they were very liberated and they were very open. I'm wondering how you feel about her dynamic within the group. I mean, she plays a very important role in the show as well.
I think in so many ways. I mean, it's narratively. I mean, I think about, because I work in television now, obviously, that Charlotte in some ways, Miranda functioned in this way too, but Charlotte also functioned as sort of like the audience in a way that, like, what are you doing? Like, oh, we can't talk about this. You know, there's, I mean, in the episode, in Running with Scissors, you know, she's like, you know, trying to pick the perfect wedding dress, and she's at brunch, and she's like, I haven't seen, you know, I have a poster for this, and I don't know if I like this dress. And then, and she's like, and then Samantha's like, have you had an AIDS test? And she's like, I'm trying to pick out a wedding dress. Can we please not talk about AIDS right now? And so there was just like so many of those moments where I think Charlotte may have functioned as like audience members who might not be ready for these, you know, women who is sexually liberated. But then there's also beautiful moments when Miranda functioned in the same way at the beginning of the second season. I think after the first season, a lot of people were critical of these women who all they focused on were men, right? Like, that was a huge criticism of the show, these successful New York City women, and all they seemed to talk about was men. And like Miranda, I think it was the episode where they... where Samantha was dating James, who had the smallest penis ever. And they were at brunch talking about this man with a small penis and balls and whatever. They were just, you know, that was Sex and the City.
Yeah.
And Miranda was like, we're four successful women. Can we find something else to talk about besides men? And so I think that, you know, Charlotte functioned in this way to sort of almost be the sort of critic sometimes. And Miranda did that as well. In a beautiful way.
We could talk about Sex and the City all day.
Obviously,
but I
want
to get real quick to your favorite episode of Orange of all time, which is, of course, your backstory episode, season one, episode three, Lesbian Request Denied.
Yeah.
The backstory episode. So, yeah. And how this, what this meant to you and how this sort of set the trajectory.
I mean, just when we shot this episode, when this episode came along, when I was cast in Orange, I just knew I was recurring. I didn't know that I would have a backstory. I didn't know any of that. I was just happy to have a job, honestly. And then I got the script for this and was just like, I just remember thinking, this is what I've been waiting for my whole career. By this time, I'm 40 years old. I had been training extensively with various teachers in New York, very seriously, doing deep dives into like acting technique with Susan Batson and later with Brad Calcaterra. I mean, I was a dance major in college, studied acting in college. And so I was just been training for a long time and not getting any opportunities. And finally, I have this episode that had this depth and this richness and all of these textures and colors that I got to play and this beautiful story. And I was just so insanely excited and just wanting to completely throw myself into it. And Jodie Foster, of course, was directing that episode. Jodie Foster. My first day of shooting Orange, actually, I met Jodie. Jodie was sort of just on set looking around and sort of getting the lay of the land. And she said, I'm directing episode three. And I didn't know episode three would even be my backstory. And so it was just unbelievably magical. Getting to work with Jodie was still one of the top three highlights of my career 7 years later. It felt so pure. And I think, you know, I got to meet with her before we started shooting, because it was the first time she'd done a television show, so she meets with the actors beforehand, you know. And honestly, I'm so glad we did that, because I don't know if I could have even acted or spoken to her if the first time I was meeting her is when we were the first day of shooting. And so I got to rehearse with her and I played a scene with her in her office. She was like, can we put the scene on his feet? And so I got to just interact with her as an artist and as a human being. And that really helped me sort of take away like Jodie Foster, the icon. But it was still insanely magical. And working with her made me just want to give my all and just be ready to do take after take after take. And we did take after take after take. And it was utterly delightful. And Crystal, Tanya Wright, who plays Crystal, my wife, was just brilliant. There was a scene when I dress for the first time as a woman in front of Crystal, and she sees me. And that was I remember that we shot that scene at the end of a very long day. I think it was like, you know, 20 hour day or something. And I remember after like the third or fourth take, Jodie pops out, you know, after, you know, all this energy. And I was just like, this is what it's about. You know, this is what it's about. And like, I need to like, you know, match this energy and this intensity. And Tanya was just so real and human. And there are just things that happened in that scene that were so unexpected than what I had rehearsed or thought the scene would be or could be. And that was because of Tanya, that was because of Jody. And it was just, it's the moments you dream about as an actor, to be on set with a with another actor in this deeply human moment, and things come up for you that you just didn't think would come up because you're just open to the moment. And Tanya says something and that sparks something in me that like creates this moment, and the moment is happening right in front of you and you're sort of surprised by it. I was sort of almost outside my body watching it. It was glorious.
No, that and again, like, you know, so early on in the series, like, you know, defining moment of this show, too. Amazing to go back and think about that first season of the show. And here we are 7 years later. You mentioned Jodie Foster, icon. Now we're talking Laverne Cox, icon.
So I don't know if I'm quite icon.
You're getting there.
Yet.
You're getting there.
I am just so blessed to still be working, to still be slightly relevant, maybe. I don't know. The times have changed so much. I'm just grateful to be working. I think the goal for me has always been to just be a working actor, you know, to find a way to do this thing that I love with all my heart. And I still love it. I still love it a lot. And I'm just so grateful that I still get to do this.
Well, congrats on the Emmy nomination.
Thank you.
And everything coming up. Looking forward to seeing what's next. Laverne, thank you for stopping by. And thanks
thank
for talking
you.
Sex and the City. This was fun.
Like, deep diving into Sex and the City. Thank you, darling. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. And that's it for this edition of My Favorite Episode. Join us again next time as we once again explore another guest's pick. And be sure to subscribe to My Favorite Episode on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or anywhere you download podcasts. Also, head on over to Variety.com for your daily fix of TV news, analysis, and reviews. I'm Michael Schneider, and we'll see you again next time.